Welcome to Britain's Energy Coast Business Clusters podcast with Adam and Alex. Today we're joined by Brett Kugelmass, from the Titans of Nuclear podcast. Welcome, Brett.
Yeah, no, it's great to be here. Thanks, guys.
How's it going? So you've given our keynote speech this morning at the start of the Global Reach conference, and it was nicely controversial and set the tone for some quite testing conversation in the industry. Would you like to just sort of give our listeners a brief overview of the four challenges that you sort of set the industry?
Generally, in these talks, what I like to do is reposition how we think about climate change and reposition how we think about nuclear. From the climate change perspective, I think it's important to understand that it's not okay to ask people to sacrifice energy, especially the poorest in the world. And not only is it not okay, it's never going to happen. Okay, so what we need to do is we need to be able to provide energy that is both clean and the cheapest possible energy. The other thing I challenge people to look at from a climate change perspective is essentially that it's not enough to go net zero, right? All our goals in the UK I learned about this week, net zero by 2050, that's insignificant. Net zero across every single sector is totally insignificant, because it is the carbon that we've already put in the air that continues to capture heat year over year. Okay, so we have to create way more energy than we thought. It has to be way lower carbon than we talk about. And that, you know, has brought me to nuclear. You know, just to give you a sense of, you know, my background, my former life was as a robotics entrepreneur. And when I was fortunate enough to dedicate my time and energies to anything that I wanted, I chose, you know, climate change as the path. And after we discovered those things and discovered only nuclear through the laws of physics alone could provide enough low carbon energy to fully account for previous emissions, that changed everything. And what we did was, my organization, we went around the world talking to nuclear experts through the Titans of Nuclear podcast. So congratulations for you guys doing the same thing. It's really, podcasting is just this incredible tool to meet a ton of people and learn so much. So I applaud you for your efforts as well. And so we met, you know, thousands of nuclear experts throughout this process. And we found that, you know, everything that we thought about nuclear was wrong. We thought it was dangerous. We thought it had all these problems to be solved. And what we realized was that the hazard from either waste or accidents is just totally insignificant. Totally insignificant, and shouldn't even be a concern for the public at all. And shouldn't have special regulations. A nuclear meltdown, as shown in Fukushima, didn't hurt anyone. Nuclear waste has never hurt anyone. The nuclear industry itself has cast nuclear as dangerous and is responsible for its own demise. And so those are the things that I like to cover in these talks.
So just building on that then, Brett, what you said there and what you said in your presentation, what do you think, how do we overcome the barriers to public acceptance of nuclear? How do we kind of overcome that hurdle to allow nuclear to be rolled out, you know, across the world in every community, effectively?
Yeah, I mean, so often I hear education is the key, right? And I both agree and disagree with that. If you're talking about school books education, forget about it. People, we send people to school and they don't know what electricity infrastructure we have. Now we want them, expect them to know how splitting the atom works. Get out of here. That's crazy. But we do educate people every day with our actions. And so when we overreact to nuclear waste as the nuclear industry, when we overprotect the plants to prevent accident, we are educating the public. We are educating the public that it's a disproportionate hazard when it is not. So the best thing that we can do to educate the public appropriately is to treat nuclear just like it's any other industry. Same rules, same way we act towards it, same levels of protection, and then people will feel just like it is any other industry.
Yeah, so a big driver of that is regulation. And I know a lot of people that are listening to your talk today will have been sort of enthused by it and at the same time skeptical of it, thinking, yeah, but regulators won't allow that to take place, or won't allow the sort of more relaxed sort of safety regulations that you're proposing. How do you think industry can work with regulation better to both convince the public that actually the regulation that we have at the moment is over the top, not necessary, but also then relax that over a period of time?
Well, I think that if we can realign the regulators themselves to act in a way that fulfills their duty to the public, right? Net public benefit may mean more nuclear reactors that melt down, but less coal plants that exist, period. That might be net public benefit, right? And that's what they're there for. That is what they're charged to do. That is their responsibility. not to protect the public from radiation, but to protect the public. And so I don't necessarily think that, you know, we need to think of this as just, you know, totally deregulation. We just need to actually have the regulators admit what is their actual job, protect the public, which means more nuclear and less everything else.
So as well as nuclear then, Brett, do you see any involvement of the other renewable technologies that we have available, or what part do they play in our energy mix going forward as well as nuclear?
Listen, I think that renewable, and I started off my career in the solar industry, right? I'm emotionally very tied to renewables, but if you look at it mathematically, their contribution is going to be a very small piece of the pie. If what we care about is actually solving climate change, if all you care about is air pollution in cities, fine. You know, let the planet bake, install renewables everywhere, and reduce the air pollution somewhat. Or you can have it all. You can have a total reduction of air pollution and save climate change by going 99.999% nuclear, and then some people who live on farms somewhere can throw some solar panels on their roof.
So for us, Brett, it feels quite strange doing a podcast with someone who's famous for doing podcasts. But where did that all start, the Titans of Nuclear podcast, and what have you learned from that?
Listen, it's been an incredible experience. I never thought, you know, when I ran my last business, that was exciting in a different way, but I never thought I'd get to meet an entire community's worth of people. Sure, in the robotics and the drone industry, I kind of knew everyone who are my business collaborators, but this is something else. So, you know, we started the Titans Nuclear podcast in order to explore the nuclear industry, understand what was going right and what was going wrong after we independently determined that it was just so important to climate change. And I've gotten a chance to meet thousands of people across the world. I got to, you know, stay at homes of people north of Helsinki in Finland. I've gotten to go to over 12 countries now. I was in Sao Paulo in Brazil last week. Now I'm here in the UK. I've gotten to make friends of, you know, all ages and backgrounds and expertise. I mean, this has really been a wild and amazing journey. And the thing that I love most about nuclear people, even though, you know, I might criticize them in my opening speech, and I might be very critical in general of, you know, where we've kind of led the nuclear world, the one thing that I cannot let go is just how brilliant, right? And how, like, well-intentioned, right? So I understand economic forces have put us in this position. It may be counterintuitive, many things that I'm saying, but the nuclear industry itself, everyone that I've met has been incredibly well-intentioned and incredibly brilliant. And they hold the keys. I mean, it's almost like a priesthood in some sense, right? They hold these, like, magic keys to unlocking this, like, unbelievable power that somehow, by who knows, you know, what properties of nature, when a star exploded and scattered uranium all over the world, it left that one element that could be unlocked to have this just incredible amount of potential energy. And the nuclear industry, you know, are the kind of the priesthood that control this. So, you know, it really has been a wild experience getting a chance to meet everybody, and I'm going to continue doing it, you know, for as long as I can and until we sort this problem out.
So over the last couple of years, you've met some incredible people, and I'm sure you've learned a lot from them. Was there at any point like a light bulb moment for you when you thought, oh goodness, I hadn't considered that before. Wow, that's a bit of a game changer for me.
Yeah. Okay. I can give you one, and it's going to be UK related. So Malcolm Grimston, who is a professor, which college is it? Maybe Imperial, or I don't know. He lives somewhere down in southwest London area. I heard him talk once at a conference at MIT, and he was the one who first explained to me that a nuclear accident isn't something out of the ordinary, right? And as Fukushima proved, the nuclear accident could happen and no one gets hurt. That's like the least accident-y of any accident I've ever heard. And yet we've been characterizing it as this thing that kills millions of people and defining rules that way and scaring the hell out of the public that way too by characterizing like that. So he was the first one who brought this to my attention, that a nuclear accident is just a normal accident like anything else, and it's our actions that have created the public fear. Our over-response to it is the real hazard. That was the light bulb moment for me. And so I actually flew out to the UK, and this was over a year ago. I don't know if you guys remember your heat wave a year ago. Mm-hmm. I brought that. You're welcome. When I came, it was sunny. I was in a t-shirt the whole week. And I got to meet Malcolm and sit down with him and conduct that interview. And that was, you know, really a real highlight for me in this experience.
So Brett, you obviously travel all over the world doing presentations and taking what you've learnt to different communities. But where did it all start for you? Where were you sort of brought up and were you university educated? Where's your career developed from?
Listen, my passion was always robotics. I started my first robotics team, FIRST. It's like an acronym for high school robotics competition. I started that when I was a kid and fell in love with it. Went to school, studied mechanical engineering, went to get my master's at Stanford, further studied robotics. You know, started a drone company, one of the first drone companies. I thought robotics was going to be my life because it's just so cool. At some point, I realized that wasn't enough. And what I wanted to dedicate the rest of my life to was something that was important.
So when you're speaking in universities, I'm guessing that's mainly in the US or is that globally?
Globally. I was out in Leeds at the start of this trip.
Oh, super. So what is the appetite amongst the sort of the graduates or student community for disruption and innovation as opposed to just sort of following in the footsteps of what's gone before?
Well, it is a bit tricky, right? Because if you have a naturally innovative and disruptive personality, you don't end up in the nuclear industry or you get forced out very quickly. It's an extremely conservative industry. And so for the last 50 years, it's been weeding out anyone who voices dissent. I think one of the reasons that when I go around and talk about these things that it's like so enlightening to people is because I haven't been in the industry. And yet I still get invited to go to all these conferences and bring this new perspective because no one can fire me. Yeah. Right? If you guys heard what I said up there, if anyone said what I said, they'd be fired the next day, even though it's all true. Right? And I put up a $10,000 prize to anyone who can prove me wrong. So go ahead, try. So it's all true. And yet anyone in the nuclear industry would be fired the next day if they said any of those things. So we've bred an extremely conservative industry. And I think there's this latent desire to change things up, especially amongst the students who kind of see their future and say, God, do I really want, I studied this for a few years, I got my PhD, but is it even really worth entering this industry if we're not going to be allowed to do anything? So that's what I think, that's the reception that I generally tend to get.
Yeah, so the culture sort of isn't right necessarily for innovation. I think another blocker to innovation in the industry is commercial structures. Frequently you see sort of cost plus, cost reimbursable models that really don't incentivize the private sector to innovate. Mm-hmm. Is that something that you've seen on a global scale, and have you seen any sort of examples of good practice, best practice, either within the industry elsewhere, or even cross-industry, of models where you think actually that breeds innovation and almost necessitates it?
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten ourselves in a bad place because we've overregulated power plants to the point where the only way to make them profitable essentially is to build these giant gigawatt scale monsters, which are then $10 billion plus endeavors. And then when you're in that category of capital, there are only a few models that can help facilitate that. And some of those models, like you were talking about, whether it be cost for difference or RAB models, these lead to somewhat bad behaviors. It doesn't lead to driving costs down. It does lead to driving costs down, having the developer take all of the risk, right? Selling things like a fixed price. Like when I take my, when I buy an iPhone, Apple produced that iPhone on their own dime and then sold it to me. They are incentivized to make their cost of production as low as possible, and then they get to capture that margin. Right, that's a good business model. I don't want to criticize, especially what they're doing at size. We'll see with the REB too much because we're in this position. We want to build nuclear. We're stuck, and so this might be the only way to actually get it built. So I'm still supportive of it from that sense. But if we're going to move towards this vision where we actually transform the entire world's energy consumption, energy generation to be from nuclear, we're going to need to come up with a very different business model.
And do you see small nuclear as a key component of that?
It could be. I mean, why not? Small nuclear, it's a funny word, right? Because even a 1.4 gigawatt scale reactor, 1,400 megawatts, the reactor itself is smaller than this room. Okay, so all nuclear is small nuclear. Us mandating by law that we need a containment dome, which makes things less safe. Let me make this very clear. Containment domes capture hydrogen and create explosive bombs, okay? No containment dome means you have no source term release, essentially, right? You just need a roof. But instead, we mandate by law a giant containment dome. That's why nuclear is big. The core is tiny no matter how much energy it produces.
Yeah, absolutely. So a complete change of thinking in the industry required, essentially, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
So just to finish up then, Brett, one question we like to ask people is, what advice would they give to their younger self if they could be, say, 20 again, starting out your career? What one nugget advice would you want to have with you that you've learned throughout your journey?
If you're well-educated and you're hardworking, don't let money-based survival instincts determine what you do for your life. You'll be fine. Find a problem that you really want to work on, something that's really meaningful to you. Somebody will pay you to do it. Just be confident about that and go forth.
Yeah, thanks, Brett. That's really, really interesting, actually. Some definite advice that we'll all take away from here. And I hope the conference room as well has really learned something. So really appreciate your time. And thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, guys. See you soon.